President Trump urges Israel to keep out two members of Congress, and Israel agrees to block their visit.
This is a betrayal of one of the core things that makes the United States and Israel alike, which is that we're strong democracies that support freedom of speech, that support different perspectives and views.
I'm Carol Hills. Why Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib aren't going to Israel after all. Also, global markets take a nosedive after Germany's economy cools off.
Look, I think that they've had a very strong past several years. They have been the anchor of the European economy, and now they are seeing the inevitable slowdown.
The UN says more than 100,000 Syrians are missing since the start of the war.
They'll come to your house, they'll stop you at a checkpoint, and you'll never be seen again.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Israel is closing its borders to two Democratic members of Congress. It says it will not allow Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar into Israel. The freshman lawmakers are the first Muslim women elected to Congress. Both are outspoken critics of President Trump, and both are vocal supporters of a pro-Palestinian movement to boycott Israel. Under Israeli law, backers of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement can be denied entry to Israel, and that's exactly what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he's doing. He made that announcement shortly after Trump tweeted out that Israel should block the visit. Kelly Magsman served on the National Security Councils of President George W. Bush and Barack Obama. She's now Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. I asked her for her reaction to Israel's move.
Well, I think it's a major mistake, and I think it undermines what has long been a very bipartisan U.S. relationship with the state of Israel. And I think it's a very dangerous decision.
Is there any precedent for this move?
Not that I can recall. I think it also potentially opens a Pandora's box with respect to other foreign governments who may want to ban U.S. members of Congress from visiting. I mean, if, for example, Vladimir Putin wanted to ban Democratic members of Congress because they support sanctions against Russia or criticize Russia for human rights, then Trump, basically just sent a signal to other authoritarian governments that they too can also take steps to ban sitting members of Congress from travel. And I think that is an extremely dangerous precedent.
President Trump tweeted on this issue just before the Israeli announcement. He said admitting Tlaib and Omar would, quote, show great weakness. Do you think that tipped the balance, the actual tweet and his weighing in on it?
It may have. It sounds like the Israeli government had agreed to allow the representatives to enter Israel. And so Trump weighing in, a U.S. president weighing in against U.S. members of Congress is, in my view, a huge mistake and quite disgraceful to the office.
A lot of Israelis and friends of Israel here are applauding the decision to bar Representatives Tlaib and Omar. What would you say to them?
Listen, I think if Israel is a strong and confident democracy, it should welcome people who have different views from them and work to try to explain the Israeli perspective. Instead, banning them is, to me, a sign of weakness and not something that's in Israel's long-term interest. These are sitting members of Congress, representatives of the American people. For the Israelis to decide to ban them because they disagree with their opinions is something that I think is deeply problematic for the relationship. It's going to potentially sow even further discord within the Democratic Party around support for Israel. And I think that, in the end of the day, is against Israel's long-term national security interest to have a weakened base of American support for Israel.
So you think this whole thing is sort of politicizing a relationship that has operated in a different way?
Absolutely. I think this is, it's unfortunate and it's highly cynical decision-making by both the president right now as well as Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I think the long-term implications of it are going to be quite grave.
I think many would say that the U.S. and Israel are very strongly allied in ways that go beyond other countries. What's different about this?
This is something that, in my view, is a betrayal of one of the core things that makes the United States and Israel alike, which is that we're strong democracies that support freedom of speech, that support different perspectives and views. And this kind of underroads the core tenet of democracy and undermines, the values that the United States and Israel have shared for decades. And this is potentially going to create even further seeds of discord and doubt about whether Israel is a confident democracy, whether it's on the right path in terms of the decisions its leaders are making. And it's certainly going to raise more questions and alarm bells within the United States about the nature of our support.
Kelly Magsiman served on the National Security Councils of Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. She's now Vice President of the Center for American Progress. Thanks a lot, Kelly.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to the global stock markets. It's been a head-snapping week. They've been down, back up, then way down, and then wait, they're up again. Investors are worried that we're headed toward a global recession. So what's going on? Joining me now is the world's Jason Margolis to kick off our coverage. Jason, you cover trade and economics for us. Why are things so shaky?
So everybody is talking about the dreaded inverted yield curve. So what exactly is that? Basically, what's happening is you can get more money for a 2-year bond than you can get for a 10-year bond. And that doesn't make any sense. Normally, when you give your money to the bank for 10 years, they're going to give you a better interest rate because you're parting with your money for a longer duration. And when you can get more money for a 2-year bond, it's a signal to investors that, uh-oh, something is wrong.
So are we heading for a recession?
Possibly, maybe, no, yes. It depends on who you ask. And if you look at the inverted yield curve, which we spoke about earlier, it is generally an indication that a recession is coming, but not a guarantee. And a recession could be coming in 10 months, 18 months. It is very difficult to predict a recession.
How much does President Trump's trade war have to do with all this?
Again, depends on who you ask. Some people say a lot, because he's slowing down trade between the U.S. and China, which are two major world economies. He's creating chaos. Supply chains are being moved from China to other nations like Indonesia and Vietnam. Businesses are wary of investing because there's so much uncertainty right now. On the other hand, that's just one part of the global economy.
So what else is there?
Well, there's a lot of tension in the world right now. There's Hong Kong. There's tension between Pakistan and India over Kashmir. China's economy has been cooling off. And then there's the latest economic news from Germany that its economy is slowing down, and that has everybody really spooked.
So what is going on with Germany? For that, we turn to Douglas Redeker. He's the chair of International Capital Strategies, a consulting firm in Washington. Doug, I always think of Germany as the economic powerhouse of Europe. How much trouble are they in?
Well, I think the Germans think of themselves as the economic powerhouse of Europe as well, so you've got good company. Look, I think that they've had a very strong past several years. They have been the anchor of the European economy, and now they are seeing the inevitable slowdown. It's inevitable because they're being hit by some internal factors, some regional factors, and some global factors. Global demand, their reliance on the automobile industry, their reliance on the chemical industry, their weakness in the banking sector, and their general vulnerability to external shocks, including protectionism and trade tension. They're very exposed to China's slowdown. They're very exposed to Brexit risk. You know, they're a strong economy with a lot of risk.
So if Germany is now facing this declining economy and sort of hints of a recession, what are they going to do about it?
Well, so this is causing some quarters of German official and unofficial sector to think about whether they need to migrate away from this strict, what they call the Schwarze Null, or the black zero, which basically means a balanced budget come hell or high water. There's some talk now about deviating from that, which would allow them to spend a little bit more, or maybe even a lot more than they have in the past, and try and get growth going within the German economy. I still think there's a great public opposition to the concept of spending more than you take in. And I think there's an even greater public opposition to spending more than you take in if that spending is for other countries.
So I'm sitting here facing an 800-point drop in the Dow yesterday. So are Germany's economic woes, are they going to add to my worries about my retirement funds?
As the largest economy in the European Union and in the Eurozone, and is the major trading partner for the U.S. and the major investor into and from the U.S., then by simple extension of one leads to the other, yes, if Germany slows down and if Germany drags Europe with it And if President Trump and Europe, and in particular Germany and German autos, end up being in an escalating trade war, then it clearly is going to hurt both valuations, investment flows, and overall market confidence in where the world's economies are going and, you know, by extension, where the U.S. stock market will go.
Douglas Redeker is chair of International Capital Strategies, a consulting firm in Washington. Thanks a lot, Douglas.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Off the coast of Italy, some 500 migrants and refugees remain stranded at sea. They were trying to cross from North Africa to Europe and were rescued by humanitarian groups. But Italy and Malta are refusing to let the two boats carrying the migrants enter their ports. The UN has been pressing European nations to allow the travelers to disembark, and today six European countries agreed to take in 150 of the migrants. Also, an Italian court has ruled that one of the vessels cannot be banned from entering Italian waters. Charlie Yaxley is the UN Refugee Agency's global spokesperson for the Mediterranean and Africa.
Well, it's a welcome development that people who have been on board the Open Arms for almost 2 weeks will now get the humanitarian assistance they need. Many of them are reportedly survivors of appalling abuses from their time in Libya. It is regrettable that it took this long to get this far.
One thing that's, of course, striking is that the six countries who are taking in these migrants, none of them are Italy, which was the country that had been kicking up all the dust about it.
Well, there's a couple of things we need to look at here. I mean, first of all, it is true that the Mediterranean states in Europe have taken disproportionate responsibility in the last few years for receiving rescued refugees and migrants. And it is important now that the other European states come forward and stand in solidarity with them and alleviate some of that responsibility. At the same time, we do need a level of objectivity to return to the discussion around this.
What do you mean by objectivity?
The number of people arriving on European shores this year is far, far lower than what we were seeing in previous years and is, in fact, back to pre-crisis levels. So what we're seeing now is no longer a crisis of arrivals, a crisis of deaths. The death toll remains broadly similar to what we saw last year. On the route between Libya to Europe alone, more than 500 people have died. And there now needs to be an acknowledgement that actually NGOs have played a critical role in preventing the further loss of life. And their efforts with saving lives shouldn't be stigmatized or criminalized. And in fact, they should be supported with other search and rescue vessels being provided by EU state operation.
And what's the total number of migrants who've tried to cross this year? What are the total migrants that have reached Europe?
It's around the 40,000 figure.
What about the migrants still on board the Ocean Viking, the other ship?
As it stands, they still haven't been allocated a port with which to dock their passengers. And it's important that they do so now. The storms have already hit. The high seas are here. And conditions on board are deteriorating. And this is no condition in which to keep people who have fled war, violence, and human rights abuses.
Your organization, the UN, has been calling on European leaders to step up and take responsibility for what's happening off their coastline. What specifically does the UN want the EU to do?
First of all, we do have to address the situation in Libya. We have called for an end to the arbitrary detention of people there and to evacuate refugees immediately out of Libya, and we need European support with that. But at the same time, we need a far increased search and rescue capacity on the Mediterranean Sea if we're to really reduce these number of deaths. And that means lifting the legal and logistical restrictions on NGOs. It means a return of EU state vessels. And it means, you know, creating an environment where shipmasters of commercial vessels in particular feel confident that if they pick people up out of the sea, they can feel confident that they won't be left stranded at sea for days on end with rescued passengers.
Charlie Yaxley is UNHCR Global Spokesperson for the Mediterranean and Africa. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Just ahead, some Syrians pay middlemen to try to find loved ones who've disappeared into Assad's prisons. It's On the World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. 8 years of war and Syria still appears nowhere close to peace. Since April, the Syrian government has been engaged in yet another crackdown on rebels. Today, rebels shot down a government jet. And caught in the middle, of course, are millions of innocent civilians. Even if the war in Syria could somehow end tomorrow, there would still be many unanswered questions. A critical one for thousands of families is what has happened to their missing loved ones. The World's Shirin Jafari has the story.
Dr. Hala El-Ghabi was pregnant with her third child when her husband went missing. It was September 2011, the early days of the uprising in Syria.
It was very hard to me. I spent the last 2 months in my pregnancy feeling very sad that maybe my son, he will not never see his father.
Hala was a surgeon in Damascus before the war started. Her husband, Muhammad Abu Hilal, was a psychiatrist. She says a few days before her husband went missing, a man called for an appointment at his clinic. When Muhammad showed up,
he saw a lot of soldiers armed and took him forcibly.
Hala gave birth to her son, not knowing if he would ever see his father. Then, after more than 2 months of anguish, she got a call. Muhammad was alive. He was in a government prison, and he was going to be released. Hala was elated until Muhammad got home.
He wasn't want to talk about his experience. From a medical and psychological point of view, I didn't want to pressure him to talk. Even I was eager to know.
It was as if her husband was a different person. He didn't speak for 2 months, didn't even show any interest in the new baby. When eventually he did talk, his stories were grim.
He was beaten routinely by the regime forces in the prison. He was put in isolated cells for more than 40 days alone.
He was starved, she says, and tortured psychologically. Shortly after her husband's release, Hala and her family fled Syria. They now live in Turkey. But their ordeal isn't over. In 2013, Syrian forces arrested Hala's brother, father-in-law, and seven of her cousins.
We don't have any information about their situation, even about their location, even they are still alive or they are dead.
It's hard to know how many Syrians have been detained and are missing. The Syrian government doesn't release figures, and it won't let human rights groups visit detention centers.
While the UN is not able to verify, reports suggest that more than...
Last week, the United Nations said more than 100,000 people have been detained, abducted, and are missing in Syria. The Syrian mission to the United Nations didn't respond to my requests for an interview. Sara Kayali is Syria researcher for Human Rights Watch based in Beirut. She says for years the government of Bashar al-Assad has used imprisonment and torture as a way to crush dissent.
Everyone at this point knows what happens if you speak against the Syrian government. They'll come to your house, they'll stop you at a checkpoint, and you'll never be seen again.
Kayali says there is no official system for families to find information about their loved ones once they are detained. That's why some of them resort to middlemen.
Because they're so desperate for answers, a lot of the families are willing to pay bribes, are willing to put themselves at risk just to get some form of answer regarding where their loved one is and if they can get them released.
Good afternoon.
Dani Kapani's brother, Mohammed, worked as a translator in Idlib in northern Syria. In 2012, security forces showed up at Mohammed's workplace and took him away. He hasn't been heard from since.
My family tried so many ways to ask about him by going to the civil registry, by going to the military police security forces branches in Damascus. And they said, no, we don't have any information about him.
Kapani works for the Syrian Human Rights Network, an NGO that's been documenting human rights abuses in Syria since the start of the war in 2011. He uses a pseudonym because he fears retribution for his family in Syria. Kapani says in the 7 years since his brother disappeared, his family's heard from plenty of middlemen.
Many people told us that you can pay money so you know where he is, or you can set him free.
But they also heard stories about scams, where someone pretending to have information about a loved one took the family's money and vanished. Gapani says sometimes the asking price is as much as $30,000.
It's a difficult issue for us.
His family hasn't paid, he says, but it's a tough choice because what if they do have credible information about his brother? Today, if you ask the Syrian government, the war is over. Assad's forces have regained control of most of the territory they had lost. But for the families of the missing and detained, they want Assad and his forces held accountable.
Madam President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for inviting me and my colleague Amina to speak here today. My name is Hala. I'm a doctor.
Hala El-Ghawi, the woman whose husband was detained, testified before the UN Security Council last week. She was there with her friend Amina Hulani. Amina and her husband were imprisoned in Syria too. They fled after they were released. But three of Amina's brothers didn't make it out. She says they were killed in prison.
As families, we have suffered enough, and I'm here today to urge you to act.
Hala and Amina have started a group that brings together the families of the missing and detained in Syria. They're collecting evidence, hoping to pressure the international community to take action. And there has been some action. Alexandra Lily Cather is with the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. She says last year her organization filed a criminal complaint in Germany against Jamil Hassan. He's a former high-ranking Syrian intelligence official.
He is now very, very sick, and he is regularly traveling abroad, predominantly to Beirut, for medical treatment. But if he, in some time, decides he wants to travel to Europe, there's an Interpol arrest warrant against him.
May El-Sadani is with the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. She thinks there won't be peace in Syria until the government answers questions about the missing and detained.
These cases may take years, decades to bring to fruition, but the fact that evidence is being collected, that the anecdotes of victims are being upheld, all of those are steps toward accountability.
Dani Gapani, whose brother is still missing, says his family won't stop looking for him.
We keep hoping, we keep having him in our hearts and minds that he is alive and he'll be free soon with all detainees.
Until then, he says, he'll keep telling people about his beloved brother. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Our coverage of how the war has upended the lives of Syrian families continues online. Follow the story of six siblings who were each resettled as refugees in different countries. It's been 7 years since they were all in the same room, but they're working to keep their bonds to each other and their homeland. That's at theworld.org. Vladimir Putin has held power in Russia for 20 years. Four U.S. presidents have tried to work with him.
I think it's a good thing if we have great relationships, or at least good relationships, with Russia. That's very important, and I believe someday that will happen.
So why hasn't it happened? I'm Carol Hills. That's next on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH in Boston, PRI and PRX. 20 years of Vladimir Putin. 20 years since he first became prime minister, then president. During that time, Putin has sat across from four American presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump.
We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
Indeed, I firmly believe that America's most significant national security interests and priorities could be advanced most effectively through cooperation, not an adversarial relationship with Russia. That's why I committed to resetting the relationship between our two nations.
Well, I hope that we do have good relations with Russia. I say it loud and clear. I've been saying it for years. I think it's a good thing if we have great relationships, or at least good relationships, with Russia. That's very important, and I believe someday that will happen.
That was Bush, Obama, then Trump. They've all had dialogues and summits with Putin and many so-called resets, as President Obama said there. But none of the resets have held. So why can't the two sides just work things out? Alina Polyakova monitors Russia at the Brookings Institution. My colleague Marco Werman recently spoke with Polyakova and asked her about some of the key moments from the past couple of decades.
So some of the key moments since the end of the Cold War that really stick out to me are Putin coming to power. The invasion of Georgia in 2008.
Now to the fighting between Russia and Georgia over the Georgian breakaway region of South Ossetia. President Bush has told Russian leaders that military action against Georgia is unacceptable. Vice President
Xi said the invasion of Ukraine following that in 2013-2014. And in the middle of all of that, of course, the protests around 2011-2012. That coincide with Putin's return to power following a brief switcheroo, you could say, between Medvedev and Putin for about 4 years.
And if you look back at all of these key moments, Alina, it seems like each president from Clinton to Obama started with optimism, but ultimately were unable to break through. Why do you think that is? Is the West unable to really understand Russia, or is it something about Putin?
You know, this is the big conundrum. You know, do we have a Putin problem or do we have a Russia problem? So the big question now is there a system of Putinism that will continue to exist even at some point Putin is no longer the man in charge? And so I think in some ways, when we try to understand why each reset failed, I think we have to look at a pattern that's emerged. So when the Bush administration pursues a reset with Putin after 9/11, especially.
We have a great moment during our tenures to cast aside the suspicions and doubts that used to plague our nations. And I'm committed to do so.
We see at the end of the Bush administration, the Russian invasion of Georgia, that's 08, that really takes the U.S. by surprise. Then we have President Obama, who comes in with a new, much more ambitious reset policy.
We resolved to reset U.S.-Russian relations so that we can cooperate more effectively in areas of common interests.
And, of course, that is followed by the Russian invasion of Crimea and Ukraine.
Russia has engaged in a military act of aggression against another country.
The president. So I think the common threat is that every time that there's an attempt at a reset, it basically is capstoned by Russian aggression at the end.
So are you saying that there's nothing any of these administrations could have done better or have a smarter strategy to have these resets and make relations between the U.S. and Russia work?
I do think perhaps there were some things that the Obama administration, the Bush administration could have done better. But at the end of the day, it was the Kremlin. It was a decision by Putin, by his advisors, to invade sovereign territory across the former Soviet republics. You know, I think in reality, there's just a profound divergence of understanding of the world between Russia and the United States. So what I mean by that is the Russian view, and this has been true for centuries, it's not just something specific to the current moment we're in, is very statist. And what that means is that there's not really a perception that small states have sovereignty rights. From the Russian perspective, it's only great powers that have the right to national sovereignty. And that's a pretty small club. It's Russia, China, the United States, maybe Europe, maybe. And so from that perspective, I don't see a way how we can really reconcile those completely opposing worldviews. Because from the Russian perspective, they basically want a return of their sphere of influence.
I mean, Alina, you put out that notion earlier of Putinism as a permanent condition in Russia. I mean, thousands of people are taking to the streets of Moscow now, essentially trying to prevent that and create a more pluralistic political system. I mean, as you look ahead to the next couple of years, beyond 2020 even, what is the best way, do you think, for the U.S. to operate with that permanent Putinism as a possible outcome?
So I don't think, you know, Putinism without Putin is the inevitable outcome. Putin is supposed to leave, according to the Russian Constitution, in 2024. There's little doubt in my mind that they will find some way for him to remain basically in power. But certainly there's, I think, an anxiety and a tension about what is going to happen over the next few years. There is no plan for Putin's succession. Putin is not immortal. At some point, he will have to leave. And I think at this point, the U.S. has to prepare for a few potential scenarios, whether it be long-term Putinism or whether that be some sort of
uprising across the country. And I think looking forward, there are many ways in which the U.S. can take some lessons from the Cold War to continue to hopefully support the Russian people who are interested in seeing a different kind of society in their lifetime, or at least in their children's lifetime.
Alina Polyakova with the Brookings Institution, thanks very much for the analysis. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Polyakova is a specialist in disinformation campaigns, political warfare tools, and a close monitor of Russia. She's speaking there with the world's Marco Werman. Polyakova raised the question of what will happen after Vladimir Putin leaves office. We'll get into that story tomorrow on The World. Now, you might not realize it, but tuberculosis is the world's most deadly infectious disease. More than 1.5 million people died from it last year. There are treatments for TB, but not effective ones for the most deadly strains. And the treatments are rough.
Visualize getting an injection every single day in one of your large muscles on your leg or in your arm, 6 days a week for 9 months. You can imagine that after like 10 or 12 days, it gets very old and you're in pain and you have trouble walking.
But now there's new hope. The Food and Drug Administration just approved a new drug regimen to treat the deadliest strain of TB. This could potentially help tens of thousands of people. Dr. Salman Khashoggi is a professor of global health at Harvard Medical School. He spent his career treating TB and trying to stop the spread of drug-resistant strains. We caught up with him before he heads back this week to a TB clinic in Russia. Salman, how big of a deal is this?
We haven't had many new drugs. A lot of the drugs for TB were made in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. And then there was this hiatus, and we didn't really get any new drugs for about 40 years. So this gives a lot of hope, because in that period, in that 50 or 60 year period, there's been a lot of drug resistance that has developed. In fact, TB is now one of the biggest contributors to global antimicrobial resistance. And so having drugs to fight the disease better than we've had in the past is really important.
So tell us about this drug. What is it and what makes it so effective?
This new drug has received approval for treatment of very drug-resistant tuberculosis. And that's a problem, because when you get TB, if you get the right medicines, you have about a 95, close to 100% cure rate. But if you get drug-resistant TB, your cure rate drops to about 50%. And if you get very drug-resistant TB, it drops to even less, about 30 or 40%. And so since this can treat the very drug-resistant strains, it offers an incredible amount of hope to people who suffer from this disease.
And where around the world do you find the most drug-resistant forms of TB?
Countries of Eastern Europe have a very high proportion of cases. So, for example, in Belarus, more than half the cases of TB were drug-resistant, starting some years ago. But you also see it in countries like India. India has the highest burden of disease in the world. And although its drug resistance levels are low nationwide across 1.4 billion people, if you go to cities like Bombay, you're looking at a quarter or more patients in Mumbai that have drug-resistant disease. And so there's pockets of drug resistance almost everywhere, India, China, Indonesia. And if you treat regular TB and you don't treat drug-resistant TB, it becomes an even bigger problem, because TB is spread in the air. It's an airborne disease. So, if you treat one strain but not another, the other strain will overtake and become the predominant strain.
So we've got this new drug. Studies show it can be very effective for this incredibly drug-resistant TB. How do we get it to the people who need it?
Well, that's the million or billion dollar question. Some years ago, so in 2012, we got another new drug. And in 2014, we got another new drug. And I thought, wow, well, surely we're going to treat 100,000 of them in the first year with this new drug. Like, it's so fantastic, right? Well, it turns out there's a couple of things that stop you from getting it to people. One is that a lot of the new drugs aren't registered everywhere. There's also the ability for health systems to find the patients that have drug-resistant disease. For years, people were just looking at patients that they thought were sick. They would have them cough up sputum and they would look at it under a microscope. And now we have better approaches. But you have to have access to that. And so these are the challenges. You make a new drug, but we haven't invested in the access aspects of it.
So at this point, are there any countries where there are people who need this drug, where the systems are set up and those kinds of approvals and access is available?
Well, I would say a good example is South Africa. South Africa is using the other new drugs. They have set up a system to screen for drug resistance in all patients, and they're able to monitor their patients. So South Africa is a great example.
Salman Khashoggi is a global health professor at Harvard University. He specializes in TB. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Tensions are still running high in Kashmir. Pakistan said today 5 Indian troops and 3 of its own soldiers were killed in a cross-border exchange of fire. India denies there were Indian casualties. The violence comes after India revoked Kashmir's so-called special status last week. The Indian-administered part of Kashmir has operated with near autonomy for decades. It's India's only Muslim-majority state. There's a long history of tension between Pakistan and India over Kashmir. They've already fought 2 wars over it. Asmat Ashai says Kashmir is much more than a flashpoint. She was born and raised there. She now lives in the D.C. area and works with Funkar International, a group that promotes Kashmiri culture, partly by producing Kashmiri music.
When you're first-generation migrants to a different country, you hold on to what you've had and you want to pass it on to your children. In the 1990s, when things were really bad in Kashmir, none of the expats here in the U.S. or anywhere else who were outside of Kashmir could take their children, because mostly, you know, we took our children in summer holidays, we took them to Kashmir. So we decided, okay, we will make Kashmir here, and we used to have youth camps. And in our own homes, we had it in our house. So we would have all the kids from northeast of America. They all drove here and they stayed here for a week. And we taught them Kashmiri. We taught them how to cook different foods. That's how we tried to preserve what we had. What I realized is raising my children here, the way they learned the language, different languages like Spanish or Arabic or French, was through music. We tried to bring that into Kashmir because I see young children not speaking in Kashmiri. So we tried to make it cool so that they could actually sing in Kashmir. There is rap, there is hip-hop, all these things kids are using to express themselves. There has always been this push to make it Indianized. I don't know what that means, because India is a very diverse country where different cultures have been there for centuries, and Kashmiri culture is one of those. And the language itself is dying because it's not promoted the way it should have been. What happens when you are in a situation like the Kashmiris are? Your self-esteem is very low. You don't feel good about yourself, and we feel like if they see that their culture, their music has value, even outside the state, outside of India, it gives them a new kind of confidence. Most of it is just being there and being with the people, scouting talent, recording music. I have a home there and I have redone it, and basically for the musicians to come and hang out there and jam. And we were supposed to go this year because we were going to do some work with them, and we haven't been able to go. Physically, I can go there, but I can't do my work. I can't find the people. Even at times when it was not a complete lockdown, there would be days that I would not be able to get my musicians to my house because they would be in areas that were under curfew. I know one thing, that we are resilient people. We will survive. We will do what we have to do to survive.
Asmat Ashai is the director of Funkar International, a nonprofit in Maryland that works to promote and preserve Kashmiri culture. Japan is now one of the world's most peaceful countries. It's even got a pacifist clause in its constitution. But go back 400 years and Japan was a violent place. Warlords were battling for supremacy, ninjas were slinking through forests, and there were plenty of samurai. But few people know that in the late 1500s, one of Japan's most legendary samurai was not born in Japan. He was a warrior from Africa. He's long been overlooked, but new research is bringing more of his story to light. Here's the world's Patrick Wynn.
Remember this name, Yasuke, because he might be the most fascinating person to have ever lived. Yasuke was born in East Africa, probably in a village in what's now Sudan, probably in the Dinka tribe. And as a kid, he gets kidnapped by slavers and taken to India. And yet, he ends up becoming one of Japan's top samurai, decked in fine silk and plated armor, ornate swords at his waist.
As a black person, when you hear the story of a black samurai, you're like, what? How did that come about? And you're intrigued.
That is Ranzo, a Canadian with Jamaican roots. He prefers to go by one name. He lives in Tokyo and has a YouTube channel called The Black Experience Japan.
Hi, welcome to The Black Experience Japan's Melanated Files. The purpose of this series is to highlight the black people living in Japan.
Ranzo is a huge fan of Japanese pop culture, and even he just found out about Yasuke. He's excited because in Japan, in movies and anime, black characters aren't always presented as heroic.
When you see a black character, it's usually the villainous character.
But Yasuke, he was a great fighter, a linguist, a nobleman, all rolled into one man.
For me, that makes him my hero.
That is Thomas Lockley, a historian in Japan. He just put out a book titled African Samurai. It's the first real study of Yasuke's life, based on historical records.
The Japanese sources gleefully describe him as having the strength of 10 men, and also being very handsome with a great demeanor. He spoke good Japanese, and in the pictures we have of him, he is extremely tall. He dwarfs the people around him.
We have records on Yasuke because he moved through two very literate worlds. Feudal Japan, but before that, the far-reaching Catholic Empire. After being kidnapped from Africa, Yasuke ends up as a mercenary in India, where he is spotted by a Portuguese missionary. And not just any missionary. This was the Pope's number one diplomat in Asia. This Catholic priest sees Yasuke and says, I want you to be my personal bodyguard. And they head off on his boat, sailing to the east.
The reason why he would have been employed was because the world was a dangerous place.
And as a holy man, you can't walk around with a sword. That was not allowed.
The best thing he could do was to employ the biggest and strongest man that he could find, and that person was Yasuke.
Yasuke wasn't just tough, though. He was a one-man secret service, gathering intel, helping with diplomacy, fending off assassins' plots. The priest and Yasuke, their ultimate mission was to find and convert the most powerful warlord in Japan. His name was Nobunaga. Everyone knows him in Japan. He's depicted in video games and films like this one. This warlord was known as an intellectual, but also the kind of guy who killed his brother-in-law so he could drink sake out of his skull. So, tough audience. And just getting to his castle near Kyoto, that meant surviving in a land of pirates, samurai, and ninjas.
Although to us today, it sounds extremely adventurous, almost with all these ninjas and warrior monks and samurai chopping each other's heads off. At the time, it would have been awful to be living there. It was a world of chaos and bedlam.
When the priest and Yasuke get to the streets of Kyoto, they stir up even more bedlam. People there have never seen someone from Africa. And here comes this handsome man in fine clothes who looks to them like Buddha. Buddha was from the Indian subcontinent, so in all the paintings they've ever seen, Buddha has darker skin.
Walking into this comes this divine giant covered in weapon, and they rioted.
They rioted because people were trying to put their hands on him. A lot of people.
There were between 5 and 10,000 people trying to get a look and clamoring to touch Yasuke.
Ranzo, the YouTuber, he says this part of the story, it really affected him.
Oh, snap. They actually viewed Yasuke in this light. They were like, man, this guy, you know, he's quite something to look upon.
The warlord, Nobunaga, he thought so too. And when he saw how Yasuke mesmerized crowds, how he'd already learned some Japanese, he said, I want this warrior in my ranks.
This man saw a warrior like himself from abroad that could tell him tales or new tactics.
1 month later, the warlord invites Yasuke to a house inside the castle walls. Yasuke, he told him, you are now a samurai. Yasuke became one of his top strategists and also threw himself into wars with rival clans. There were these battles with flaming temples and double-crossing samurai generals and severed heads. And you know what? If I spoil the ending, you will hate me because Yasuke's story is about to get really famous.
We have got some really exciting news for Chadwick Boseman fans as the star is trading in his Black Panther claws for some samurai swords.
That's right. Boseman is going to play the first African samurai in history in a new movie. According to Deadline, the actor will play Yasuke, who was
the first. This is going to be awesome, especially for Black fans of Japanese pop culture around the world. And there are a lot, Ronzo says.
Oh, man, I'm excited. Look, if the movie is anything like the book, it's going to be like, honestly, it's going to be a blockbuster. It's going to, whether you're Black or whatever color you are, I think the story within itself, it will resonate with a lot of people.
The movie isn't formally connected to the book, but still.
To see Yasuke, this man who I have brought back to life, if you like, on the big screen will be a dream come true.
And by the way, Lockley couldn't prove it, but evidence suggests that Yasuke had children, so the great samurai's descendants, they're likely still walking around in Japan. For The World, Patrick Nguyen.
Let's have the London-based group Abibio Sound Machine take us out today. The voice of lead singer Eno Williams and the pulsating rhythms of the band are heard on this tune, Kuka. Boku twaka te mi yami, bami yami, bami perami, bami yami, bami perami. The World's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. I'm back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.